the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. We got a great show for you today. Two great guests, plus a quick 10-hour little game show. You don't get any more fun than that. First up, we have Brett Ronzeville. He has, boy, what an interesting career. Worked at Disney. You know, I'm just so jealous of that. And then worked at Twitter during the Elon times. We will ask him about that, of course. And he has a new company now, a new SMS e-commerce shopping platform called Yes More and Co. Very interesting idea. I'm pretty impressed. And I think that you will love hearing from Brett. He has some great stories and some great information. After that, we're having Daniel Veroni with us. He is a small business growth expert, and we're going to talk about how us small businesses are the growth engine of America and what we need to do to keep that going and to push for more SMB pro policy from our politicians. We just don't get that. And then we have the Quick 10 with Debbie Dashinger. We will love that. I am always excited to play the Quick 10. There is nothing more fun. And so great show. Oh, and please go buy the book, Real Environmentalist, and give it a nice 5-star review. If the idea that the environment is important to you, but that people are already solving some of the problems called entrepreneurs, if that idea appeals, please go get a copy. We'll be right back to get started with a great show. We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited for my first guest today. He is not only doing something cool now, but in his career, on his resume, he has my favorite job perhaps of all time, and so I'm really jealous of Brett Ronzeville. Welcome to the show. He is now doing SMS e-commerce on a platform called Yes More and Co. They have a really cool thing during the holidays. You get a new prepackaged purchase that you may want to. Yes, I want that and more. And so he is working on that. Now we will learn all about it. The cool thing in his resume, he has had some really interesting experiences. He was at Twitter during those special times, as they call them, and was at Disney doing park design and park decoration, which is, as you know, my dream job. Anything at Disney, I would love it.
Brett, oh, no way. I could talk about that all day. I'm great, Jim. Thanks for having me. So fancy meeting you here. I could talk about my Disney days all day long. All I ever wanted to be was a theme park designer from the time I was 8 on. And I worked towards that goal for 16 years and then eventually got to live the dream.
Well, do give us one juicy Disney story, Brett. So one cool thing that you worked on that you were proud of that was fun. Give me one thing to be jealous of.
Oh, yeah. Well, the last big project I worked on was the Finding Nemo submarine voyage. So I did some set design there, some set decor there. And then I did lots of holiday decor, like Christmas and Halloween stuff. And the department I worked in was actually really fun because they owned everything from concept to installation. So you'd pitch the idea, you'd build the idea, and then you'd go into the park and install the idea. So when you went in on the weekends and saw people smiling at whatever you were working on, you got this great sense of ownership. It was awesome.
Ooh, that is neat. I am jealous. Why'd you leave?
Well, there's a couple different reasons. The most honest answer is that I loved my job and I thought I would never leave, but so did everyone else that I worked with. And I was like in my mid-20s and looked around and realized I had to start waiting for people to die before I moved up in the company. And so I actually just was taking some time off. I thought I was taking a month off of work, and I made a list of 50 things I always wanted to do. And I told everyone I wasn't going to come home until I did them all. And I wasn't going to spend any money on lodging. And I genuinely thought I was just taking a month off of work in between projects. And instead, it took me 2 years to cross everything off that list. So it was 2 years of sleeping on park benches and strangers' couches and podcasting and blogging weekly.
Is that when you were a minor internet celebrity?
Yeah. It actually got pretty big. I was on Good Morning America and Fox News and CNN, the whole shebang.
Wow. Promoting...
What you were not just promoting, just being a hobo. And people were fascinated by the life of someone who left a job like Disney to go do all the other things he wanted to do.
A real life Forrest Gump.
Yeah. A lot like that, actually.
And what were some of the things you did along the way, those 50 things that you were so excited about?
Oh my gosh. So many of them were because I felt like I was born in the wrong time or place, because I was born and raised kind of in rural California. So some of them were as simple as like catch a firefly or be part of a Civil War reenactment. But then some of them were like drive a race car, go hang gliding. And maybe the most memorable was milking a cow on Amish farm.
Okay. I can see the joy in that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was super fascinating just hanging out with some folks who were so different from myself and getting to experience their life firsthand and just being treated with kindness every step of the way. If there's two things I learned from that trip, it was one, that 99.9% of people are genuinely good when you're one-on-one. It like just renewed my faith in humanity to the nth degree. And the other lesson I learned was that I am far better than the average person at being uncomfortable, both socially and physically.
Okay. That's a good skill to have, you know, with the doomsday coming and all.
Oh, yeah. It's not too shabby.
Is the average Amish person with all of their lacking electricity and lacking Nintendo and all the other important stuff, are they happier than the average American with all of those conveniences?
Oh, geez, who knows? That's hard to say. I do know that the family I hung out with was very happy and they didn't have a problem filling their days. The guy I hung out with the most was the patriarch of the family. He was in his late 50s. His name was Dan. And he took me into the backyard and we played quoits for like a couple of hours. I had never heard of the game before. Are you familiar with quoits?
Nope, never heard of it.
So it's sort of like horseshoes, except the horseshoe is completely round and the spike is very short. But otherwise, you're just throwing this big heavy metal disc across the lawn. And I have never been so badly beaten in a game before than I have been by a late 50s Amish guy playing a game that was already in his own backyard. Like, he clearly had spent plenty of time throwing metal discs across his lawn, and I've just showed up to be laughed at.
Well, wait till he sees Nintendo.
Yeah, I could take him down at Mario Kart any day.
Well, very interesting. All right, let's talk about what we're supposed to talk about.
Sure.
Yes More Go. Explain the model, please.
Yeah, Yes More and Company. So what it is just dead simple shopping, like completely frictionless commerce. So the idea is during the regular year, once a week, you get a text message that features a product that you're sort of predisposed to like. When you get the text message, if you like what you see, you just text back yes, and it shows up at your door in a couple of days. Just no other action. They're usually pretty cool things from small brands that you might not be familiar with. And then during the holidays in particular, so coming up right now, we do a holiday promotion that we call holiday shopping on easy mode. So once a day from mid-November to mid-December, you get a text message every day, broad swath of different products. You say yes half a dozen times and your Christmas.
So do I put my whole family in, the ages of the kids and all of that kind of stuff? Or is it just shopping for me, my clothes?
For the holiday season in particular, we give you just a broad subset of products. So one day might be soaps, and one day might be journals, and one day might be a really cool set of fancy teas with a teapot or something. And so like any given day is going to be the perfect gift for someone on your list, but we don't try to ascribe who it's going to be perfect for during the holidays. There's just too many variables to limit the fun.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Yes. All right. And then it just shows up. So I have one a week and then 25 after, or 25 days for the holidays, I guess. Mm-hmm. Makes a ton of sense. How do you curate your products?
Yeah, we have partnerships with probably upwards of 100 really great brands now. So you mentioned that I was at Twitter briefly. I was at Twitter because I helped start this local commerce company that was acquired by Twitter. And what we did there is we worked with these small brick and mortar stores in a given geography. And it gave me like such an affinity for these small business entrepreneurs, especially the ones working in retail, that I wanted to have an excuse to work with them across the US, not geographically constrained. And so a lot of this came from the idea that I just wanted to go out there and meet a ton of awesome small time entrepreneurs who were building businesses around very cool products. And that's really what we go out looking for. Like, I talked to one woman just today who, I guess, spoiler alert, one of the items that's going to be out for Christmas is sort of this like go bag hiking kit, like this perfect kit of things that you need if you're going to go out hiking to get for someone who enjoys the outdoors. But her story is fascinating because she literally got lost in the woods one day, like after getting her finance degree. And then sat there waiting for someone to find her, just making a list of all of the things she wished she had with her in that moment. And so every brand has like a great story and a great founder behind it, and will make an awesome gift for someone on your list.
So just sitting there and waiting was her solution?
Yeah. Just, I mean, to be fair, it was probably the right solution.
Hoping to God someone finds me.
I think that she had put some sort of message out into the world. Like, there was reason to believe that people would find her, but I don't have details on that.
Okay. Sounds like she needs more than a finance degree.
A compass couldn't hurt, I guess.
Yeah. But yeah, I want the product though, you know, I
mean,
having someone lost, I wish you need to modify that story a little bit, Brett, you know, just, don't tell 100% the truth of that story. Disney it up a little bit for us, okay?
That's fair.
She fell out of an airplane, landed on a soft pagoda of oriental pillows, and survived, and met a panda who befriended her.
A sacred panda. But the brands that run the gamut. So we even have like some much bigger brands. You might have heard of like Firebelly Tea. So Firebelly, we have like some bundles that we offer during the holidays, or truffle hot sauce. So there are some like pretty some brands where if you're pretty tapped in, you will have heard of them, and we have some great stuff from them, all the way down to these folks who are still getting started in their garage.
Right. Well, very cool. Whose job is it to find all those?
Oh, myself and another buyer and merchandiser that we have on the team. But it's genuinely the fun part. So we don't have trouble fighting over who gets to do it.
I think you're big enough now that you need to outsource that.
Yeah. Do you want to take on part of that
I'll
job?
I'll do that. I'll bite the bullet to do that for you.
It really is the fun part. I can see you doing a great job at it.
Yes. I'll start in San Diego.
That sounds like a good idea. What do you have a favorite like direct to consumer product in the San Diego area already? Do you have someone on your mind?
No, I was just thinking, you know, nice place in America that I haven't been recently.
Oh, I see. Yeah. That's fair.
I'm not answering that question until I sign the paperwork there.
You're just looking for some free travel. You're like, I think I heard about a new D2C brand that's operating out of Walt Disney World.
Do you have an Elon story? Were you there when he was there? It kind of looks like the same time.
Oh, man, I certainly have some Elon stories, but I don't know that I am willing to share them on the radio. Suffice it to say, I was not part of the layoffs. I was called, quote, critical and exceptional, and then left. Thank you. And then left immediately. Oh, wow. Oh, stop. Oh, no. Oh, thanks. But then left immediately afterwards. The opportunity costs of sticking around were way too high. There's too much exciting stuff to do on the other side of Twitter.
Site's still working, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
So was he right to fire all those people?
Well, I guess you can say the site is still working. It's harder to say whether or not the business is still working. I think one thing that is important to note about businesses like Twitter is that it's really easy to say, how many engineers could it possibly take to get 280 characters on my phone? But what people don't often think about is how many people it takes just to manage the Disney account. So like, yes, there were 8,000 people, but so many of those people were the ones bringing money in the door by actually running an advertising business that is attached to small messages.
That makes sense. Yes. And I bet a lot of those people left with, yeah. Oh, well. All right. So back to Yes More Co. All right. Curate. How'd you get this idea, and what were the first steps you took?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
give us some history.
Yeah, absolutely. It came a little bit from the remnants of that other company, the one that sold to Twitter. I knew that I wanted something that wasn't geographically constrained. I knew that I wanted something where I could work with small brands. And I knew I wanted something that just stripped out every possible inconvenience in the chain that I was working in. And so I joke around, like, if I could make it so that you could just grunt in the general direction of your phone to buy something cool, I would. Instead, I settle for you having to type in three letters. And that was sort of the impetus. And then there were some changes to the business model in the early days. Like there was a period where we handled all the fulfillment. And I actually sort of missed that. I would like to get back to that at a larger scale. But it really all starts with, I love small businesses, I love cool brands, and I want to make everything dead simple.
I like that. That's a great way of doing it. Supposedly, that's the same model they used when they were designing Cirque du Soleil, was get rid of all of the expensive things like stars and famous people and animals.
And yeah, left and it works, man.
Look exactly alike, so you don't know who the star is, so you don't have to pay that person much, and animals to move around.
Yeah, and they put on an incredible show. I went to one last year with my kids. I have a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old girl, and I was as in awe when we were going into this, is how fascinating SMS is, just in general, text messages. Like the open rates are astonishing. And I had just read a book called Range by, I want to say the author's name is David Epstein. And there's a story in there about Nintendo and their early philosophy about lateral thinking with withered technology. And I just felt so sure that there was all this opportunity in text messages, even though they're like sort of three text cycles behind, just because they get the job done so efficiently.
Why are, you're right. I open every text message. So how do you get so many numbers?
I mean, by offering a great service. So you just go to like yesmoreandco.com and put in your number, and we charge a one-time membership fee that covers basically the costs of the text messages. And for that one-time fee, you get sent tons of cool brands with interesting stories, and you say yes a few times and you get great stuff. We have way more power users than I ever expected to have. Like basically, if you buy once, you are just as likely to buy every other time.
Okay. But my question was, how do you get new number? How are you marketing? How are you building your,
How do we literally do customer acquisition?
Yeah.
Yeah. We have, the big mover is a referral program that we have. So we, every time you refer a friend with your unique link, then you get a 2% discount on everything that you buy for the next month. But what makes it interesting for people is that there is no cap on that 2% discount that you get per friend. So for every 50 friends you invite, you basically just get free stuff for a month. So like everyone gets to be kind of their own influencer.
That's a cool tagline.
Yeah. I just made that up, Jim. I'll go copyright it right now.
Done. Got it. All right. Did you raise money to build this? You bootstrapping? What's the financial model look like?
Mostly bootstrapping. I raised like a very small amount of money, just like a friends and family round to get started. But what we're doing is low cost enough and high ceiling enough that we're pretty happy bootstrapping right now.
Okay. You're not going to tell us how much you raised? Is it a little?
I can tell you. Yeah, it was a little. It was 50,000. Okay. Not much at all. Yeah.
And
I guess not much at all by venture capital standards. No, yeah, I admit that I'm coming to this with a big Twitter size bias.
And who built the tech?
Myself and my partner, John. So there's two of us who co-founded together.
And you were both tech competent to actually write the code.
Yeah, exactly. And John and I, in fact, had worked together previously at another company called the Go Game, which is sort of the first startup I ever worked for.
And do you still pay per text that you send when you do this? You have to buy those texts.
Like, does it cost us money to send a text message?
Yes, does it?
Yes, yeah, it absolutely does. We end up spending about $2 a year sending text messages to people, to each person.
Okay, to each person.
Yeah.
Well, that's insignificant if they buy anything. And then do you sell on the normal retail model of you double the price that you got it for?
Not double, because we're also largely not handling the fulfillment. The brands are. So our margins are usually between maybe 15% at the very low end up to around 35 or 40%.
Okay. Interesting that you don't do your own fulfillment. So that leaves that critical piece out. I guess you could get a nicer touch that way if it comes personalized from that brand that you were just excited to buy a product from. Is that the idea?
Yeah, it varies by brand. The idea from an operations standpoint is that it very much streamlines our process. So while we're at this stage of growth, it's very, very easy for us to scale up and down the number of drops we're doing. We don't have to do a lot of demand forecasting around how much inventory we want to bring into a fulfillment center. But all of that said, I mentioned earlier, I would love to get back into the fulfillment being handled in-house, because in the early days when we just had like 200 users that we were testing things out on, we would do all the fulfillment ourselves, and we would package in every single order like a little bonus item. There was always a photo booth prop with like a joke or a pun on it about the product. It's hard to describe without the visual, but it's like a little speech bubble that has a joke about it.
Yeah.
And that was like such a fun thing for people to unpackage, and also led to so much UGC, user generated content, where people would like post photos of themselves holding up those photo booth props on like Instagram or TikTok or something. And I miss those days. I would really love to get to a scale where we could handle fulfillment again, if only because that customer experience is so fun to my mind. And then also us handling fulfillment means that we get to make things feel just totally magical from that dead simple perspective, where the workflow when we're handling fulfillment is customer will get a text message. They'll open it up. They'll go, "Oh, that's really interesting." They'll text yes. And then we'll charge their card, tell them that the item is on the way. And then literally like 5 minutes later, they'll get an email that gives them their tracking number. And for all intents and purposes, like the shipping process has begun, because there's nothing between us and shipping. All of the fulfillment processes can happen completely asynchronous from the actual sale, meaning like we already know exactly what we're selling, exactly how much it weighs, exactly how much it's going to be packaged, and exactly how many units we're going to sell that day. So like the only thing standing between a sale and a ship is a literal printing of a shipping label.
An amazing story. I can't wait to play with it and to watch it grow over the next year or so. How do we sign up, download the platform, get in touch, follow online, all that stuff, please?
Yeah, nothing to download. Like I said, we keep it dead simple. You go to yesmoreandco.com. You put in your phone number, you put in your credit card information, and you're off to the races.
All right. Well, I will play for Christmas and see what I get. Thank you so much for being awesome with us, and we'd love to have you back. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, you bet. Can't wait to have you on board, Jim.
And we will be right back.
No action on climate change? Introducing The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalist. Thank you.
We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. We all know that small business is important. I guess we don't really talk about how important it is, and we need to do that more. Please welcome Daniel Veroni to the show. He is author of a new book called Rethinking Economic Growth, How to Gather Your Power and Take Action. It is 5-star rated on that Amazon place. He is also the founder and CEO of Potomac Core, which is an organization that he uses to talk to. We will find out exactly who. Trade organizations, I think. Daniel, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for including me.
Is that your customer, the Trade Organizations of America?
They are the trade associations. These are the corporate trade associations. They represent corporations in every sector and segment in the economy.
Okay, so the National Association of Dental Hygienists.
So if they are a trade association, yes, but not every professional organization is a trade association.
What's the difference, so here's the, then? What does trade question. Mean?
So essentially, the core element of a trade association value imperative is policy and advocacy. It's that component that helps shape a better business environment for an industry sector. So if a professional organization can be in policy and advocacy, but not every one of them is.
Okay. And what kind of services would they need? What do you do for them?
So when you think about all the challenges in the economy, all the new technologies, and you go back from the end of the Great Recession in the 2008-2009 window, and then you go into COVID, and then you look at the rapidly emerging technology, here's what you come away with, is that the world is moving faster, change is happening faster. There are shifts in different markets that require an industry to be able to respond and react accordingly. Trade associations have evolved to the front porch of the industry that they serve. And what I mean by that is that they are heavily engaged in industry promotion and policy and advocacy. But the services that I offer help those trade associations become a strategic partner to the industries they serve. And the way that I do that is with market research, both qualitative and quantitative, to help the trade association understand how aligned or how connected they are with the industry they serve. And then we build a strategic plan that is based on an outside-in strategy. Where is the industry now? Where does the industry want to be in 3 to 5 years? how is this trade association going to be a strategic partner to them and help them get there? So it is a strategic planning and market research that helps that trade association be far better aligned and connected to the industry they're serving.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. So when you think about industries that are seeing disruption, so I'll give you an example of the automotive industry. So a few years ago, we heard from the Automotive Industry Association. They're called the Alliance for Automotive Innovation. There are 39 global automakers on their board of directors, and they said to their trade association, we need an 11-year roadmap. Can you find someone in here that can help us put it together and figure it out? So my research team and I worked together with the board to conduct qualitative research to identify those things that would prevent their innovation and help their industry evolve through a disruptive period. So we took the research, we partnered with a group of the board of directors, and over a six-month window, we built out a 11-year roadmap that would help the trade association evolve in a way that they could be far more nimble and help position the industry to get through any challenges, regardless of the party in power.
All right. Party in power, do you help influence or decide things like that? Or are there certain associations that need help in certain political smoke-filled rooms?
So we stay out of partisan politics by design and by desire. Ability to advocate and to shape policy. But if you're going to get involved in political type things, you've got to create a political action committee and comply with a different set of rules and regulations and comply very strictly. So we don't do that kind of work.
That makes a lot of sense. I think that would be some minefields to avoid. Perhaps. So.
That is absolutely correct. I will tell you, I've in my 13 and a half years between working with clients and writing two books, I've interviewed 2,300 different industry leaders. And I will tell you that they are all over the map politically. And what I emphasize, actually what my clients know, is that they're there to influence policy that's going to help shape a better business environment for their members, and they don't get involved in the politics of things.
Right. All right, so let's talk about the book and learn from it. Rethinking Economic Growth, How Small Businesses Can Help Consistently Grow the Economy. Talk to us about this. What percent are small businesses of the economy? I thought it was
99.9%.
How much?
99.9% with the average small business at 8 employees or fewer. 2 of 3 new private sector jobs come from small businesses. Half the U.S. workforce are employed by small businesses. Small businesses represent 45% of the U.S. economy.
All right. And then why do they never talk about us? I've never heard small business brought up on the debate stage during a presidential election. Am I incorrect?
So you are not incorrect. And while there will be committee chairs, either in the House of Representatives or the Senate, that will speak favorably of small business, that they believe they're doing things to help small business, that the Small Business Administration is saying they're doing any number of things to help small business. But what I learned in this book is as follows. The key point is that in the window from 1961 to 2024, this country had not grown consistently at 3%. And the reason why that matters is because we're a $30 trillion economy. If we grow at 3%, that's about $1 trillion that we can invest back into the economy. So if we're not growing, or that growing is what I call episodic, that sometimes you see it, new administration comes in, new policies, you don't see it, you see maybe 1 to 2% growth. So what I researched is I identified who the key drivers or who could be a key driver that could consistently grow the U.S. economy. And what I learned was it was small businesses. The fact that there are 33 million of them, the fact that they are the economy, they're not a piece of the economy, and with the right policy framework, they would grow. So here's an interesting data point. So with the government shutdown, we don't have new government data. But ADP, who's a private organization, came out with data today. And lo and behold, companies between 1 and 19 employees lost 15,000 jobs. Companies 50 to 249 employees lost 25,000 jobs. So the job market, or the labor market, as the Federal Reserve calls it, is in a period of contraction. But if we had the right policies in place, I believe that small businesses would be hiring, creating new jobs, and we'd have economic growth as far as the eye could see.
And what policy changes would you advocate for?
So the first one is, and I've got an op-ed coming about this anytime now, is the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that was signed by President Trump last July. I'd like to see the tax cuts made permanent for small businesses. Small businesses suffer from a high degree of uncertainty. I interviewed 35 of them for my book, and what they told me time and again is uncertainty is their biggest enemy. Let's give them uncertainty with tax policy. The second thing that I would do is I am proposing in a soon to be op-ed article that says that we ought to have scaled regulations for small businesses. If you are a multinational corporation, you've got plenty of resources, dollars, and people to figure out ways to comply with new regulations. If you're a small business, you're far more challenged. You're taking very precious, limited resources away from those companies. And what I'd like to do is have a scaled set of regulations for small companies so they can comply without breaking their back and breaking the bank.
Okay. I just don't know how. So which parties will advocate for this? Some of the, not necessarily all Republicans, will advocate for this. A lot of the Chamber of Commerce Republicans won't vote for this, Dan, will they? And I think on the Democrat side, we have the same problem. There are a lot of Democrats that will vote for this, but a whole bunch that are not going to.
You know, it really all comes down. So, you know, when you're talking about the economy, it's not the money, it's the money. You need money not just to fund the government, but money to invest back into the United States and into communities. And in order to do that, you know, it sounds great. Oh, we'll just raise taxes on the wealthy. The greatest share of revenues coming from taxes come from the middle class, for God's sakes. What I'm suggesting is that we can create higher revenues by giving these small businesses the certainty they need through a permanent tax code that will be beneficial to them. So in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, there's 100% expensing in the first year for plants and equipment. I will tell you that a similar application in the first Trump administration just for equipment really helped create an economic boom in this country. When President Reagan was president back in the 80s, he signed a somewhat similar tax bill, and there was about 25 years of growth. So what I'm talking about is highly stimulative for jobs and economic growth, and it really matters. And when I wrote this book, so you know, I didn't write this for Republicans or Democrats. I wrote it for Republicans and Democrats, that if they want the economy to grow, there are 12 case studies in this book. There are 35 small business leaders cited in this book that they need to read it. And after they read it, I'm happy to talk with any of them that want to have a conversation. And then move forward in a bipartisan way to create a certain environment that will grow jobs and grow the economy on a consistent basis.
Can you tell us about some of the people that you wrote about?
Sure, happy to.
Give us a couple of cool stories.
Yes. So I'm going to talk about the tooling and machining industry, a very cool industry. There aren't many products that aren't made with this kind of precision manufacturing, from rockets to airplanes, the dishwashers, and so on. There's a cool story in there in that one of their CEOs based in the Cleveland area was seeing a problem gathering employees. So he went to other small tooling and machining businesses in the greater Cleveland area and said, why don't we go to the county prosecutor and find a way for us to hire nonviolent felons after their release from prison. Now, two-thirds of nonviolent felons that are released from prison can't find work. So they were able to strike an agreement with a county prosecutor, and these businesses have hired nonviolent felons. They've addressed their worker shortage, and they've also helped to reduce the recidivism rate in their local area in the greater Cleveland, Ohio. I mean, that is about as exciting a story as you can think of, right?
Great story, yes.
Yeah. Another one is that, you know, we hear about how technology is going to take away jobs. So in the wooden pallet industry, there's a CEO of a company that purchased some equipment and, you know, in automation and so on. And what he did is he got his current employees trained to use it and did not let any of them go, which is just phenomenal. What I want to emphasize in this conversation is that small business are there. They adapt quickly. They're innovative. And unlike small businesses getting to decisions and action, it's the battleship and the bathtub analogy, where small businesses can react and respond far more quickly, and they can be more innovative. And I'm just giving you an important example of that with just a couple of industries.
Very good examples. Very cool. So, is this entirely a federal issue? Is it not a state issue? We have the states with no income tax. Are those as good as we're going to get? Should we all just keep moving to Florida and Texas?
So, a very interesting and important question that you've asked, because here's where we are today. So, you've got states that are getting more aggressive with regulations and legislation at the state level and now at the local level, that is also impeding small business. So there has to be a national commitment at every level of government to grow the economy and to leverage small business to do that. And it's imperative that that happen, because if we do that, then the economy grows. You know, right now, we're about polarization and about arguing about any number of things under the sun. But at the end of the day, it's not the money, it's the money. What I propose through this book, it's about elevating the standard of living and quality of life in every community around this country. That's why I spent a year and a half researching and writing this book, because I saw it as a solution. Too many people in the 10-mile radius in and around Washington, D.C., focus a lot on problems and a lot of disagreements. I wanted to come up with a tangible solution. That's what this book is.
All right. I love that. As an individual owner, what do we need to do? And it used to be support the chamber. Let me ask you this, Daniel, before I ask this question, what should I do as an individual owner? Are you witnessing the death of chambers in your area as well?
No. I mean, here's what I would offer to you. So here's something new to share with you about the book. I learned that every one of these small businesses is part of a magnifier effect in their local communities. They help one another solve problems. They help one another come up with solutions to grow their employee base. They help one another innovate and brainstorm new and different ideas. And that's like imperative. At the same time, what I learned when I interviewed these 35 small business leaders is they're all engaged with their local organizations, their state organizations, and their national organizations, because they recognize they recognize a key tenet of Washington, D.C. You're either at the table or you're on the menu.
Wow, that's a line right there. We'll tweet that one out. And what about economic growth? What's your prediction for the end of, as our number wraps up here for 25? What do you think it's going to be, and what do you think it's going to be for 26?
Oh, I love that question. So we're almost 4% where we stand now, and that 4% comes from, in large part, the investment in technology, automation, and AI. Those tools will dramatically increase productivity, especially for small businesses, and make the economy stronger. As we go into 2026, my expectation, so right now, the interest rates for money, so small businesses need a lower cost of capital to go out and take loans. Right now, interest rates are between 3.75% and 4%. I am advocating through previous op-eds to get that rate down to as low as 3%. If that happens, and I feel confident the Federal Reserve will get pretty close to that after the December and January meetings, I believe that small businesses, the recovery in 2026 is going to be a small business, not a led recovery, but an impressive a period of economic growth. They're going to leverage the small business exemptions. They're going to buy plants and equipment. They're going to hire, and they're going to grow. And I would expect the economy next year to grow easily between 3% and 4%.
Ooh, I hope so.
But what I would also tell you is that with the productivity improvements and what I call the supply side investments, meaning these tax investments, I believe you'll see inflation and prices come down. Now, we will see that in bits and pieces in the first half of the year, but we will absolutely see that probably at the end of the second quarter and then the third quarter of 2026.
All right. I'm going to hold you to that. We will show up at your house with shovels if you get it wrong. Dan, I love this topic. I love the idea that small business people need to be venerated more. And as a macro, we need to, you know, be discussed. And again, I want a debate topic in the next election cycle on what is your small business policy, you know, and watch them just fumble through it.
Yeah.
How do we find out more? Follow you online, get in touch.
So you can find me at danielveroni.com or at potomaccorp.com. But you can find out more information about the book. So for all of your listeners that are small business owners, please go to Amazon right away, immediately, and look for Rethinking Economic Growth. There is a roadmap and a way forward for every small business in the last chapter of the book. They'll get to read through these case studies and get a sense that there are other industries that have their problems, but they're overcoming their challenges, and it will give them tools to help them be successfully locally and nationally. So it's Rethinking Economic Growth at Amazon.com.
Fantastic. Dan, thank you so much for being with us, and we'd love to have you back and continue the fight for small businesses.
Happy to do it, and thank you for having me.
And we will be right back.
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, Jim.
Oh my gosh, I love the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, that's a great one.
You know, that is a phenomenal question.
That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer.
That's a great question.
Oh, that is such a loaded question, and that's actually a really good question.
School for Startups Radio.
We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. We have another brave contestant willing to play the Quick 10. Please welcome Debbie Dashinger to the show. Debbie, welcome. How are you doing today?
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to play and see what comes out of all of this. Great to be with you, Jim.
I heard that you do want to play. I have to ask, state law requires, are you currently sober?
I am sober, yes.
Okay, great. Do you want to accept the standard wager, Debbie? The standard wager.
What is the wager?
The bet that everyone else has made.
What is that?
Thing that everyone else agreed to under peer pressure.
That I can do it? That
yeah,
I can answer?
So say yes.
Okay.
There you
I'm
go.
On the heck yes.
Number one, your favorite creativity hack.
Schedule creativity. For example, recently I scheduled an event with a friend and we went to paint mandalas with a singing goddess choir behind us. It was awesome. So schedule your creativity.
Number two, favorite bootstrapping trick.
Oh, honey, never give up. Never give up. Always find a creative way out. Persevere.
Number three, name your top passions.
My dogs. Travel, music, personal development, laughing.
Number four, the first three steps in starting a business are?
The first three steps in starting a business are start with a strong business idea, focus on solving a problem, and fill a market need.
Number five, the best way to get your first real customer is?
Offer it for free. Get testimonials after you give them something for free, written or video testimonials. Ask for referrals and market the testimonials.
Number six, your dreamiest technology is?
Amazon, because it gets you right away.
Number seven, best entrepreneurial advice.
Identify a weakness. Do it better. You could also call your clients. You could call your customers, poll them, ask them what they feel is lacking, and then fill that gap.
Number eight, worst entrepreneurial mistake.
Doing everything alone, never getting coaching or hiring help, the worst.
Number nine, favorite entrepreneur and why?
Tom Moynihan, the founder of Domino's Pizza. He was an orphan as a child. He became a Marine. He grew Domino's to 6,600 stores. He was almost bankrupt multiple times. He fought one of the most visible trademark cases of all times. And then in the early 1980s, he purchased his favorite childhood baseball team, the Detroit Tigers, and he sold Domino's in 1998 for $1 billion, and he started it with $60.
Number 10, favorite superhero?
Beast Boy. He's the green-skinned member of the Doom Patrol and later the Teen Titans. I love Beast Boy because he has the power to transform into any creature of any size, and he's basically a shapeshifter.
All right, excellent answers. While we calculate the score and find out the winner of our wager, how do we get in touch with you, Debbie? Find out more about you, get your books, all that, please.
Thank you so much. This was fun. Yes, you can go to my website, debbie-dashinger.com. It's Debbie with an I and Dashinger, Dachinger with a C, debbie-dashinger.com.
Fantastic. We're just kind of pausing until, I've been given your score from the judges. Debbie, you got a 94. It's an excellent score, but you have to have a 95 to win. And so you owe us a Tesla. We always play for a Tesla. So you owe us one of those. I'll be looking forward to it.
Yes. What color? Name your color.
Red, please.
Red Tesla. Okay. Putting in the order.
All right. Thanks a lot, Debbie. Great answers, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Be well. Right. Thanks, Jim.
We are out of time, but back soon. Be safe, everyone. Take care, and go make $1 million. Bye now.